Hello, my name is Linda Jakobsen. I'm the East Asia Program Director at the Lowy Institute for International Policy. I'm joined today by a colleague, Dr. James Riley, who's written a very interesting paper about China's economic statecraft. So I thought it would be fun to talk about this paper, perhaps also talk a little bit about foreign policy actors and various actors within the bureaucracy, a subject I've done some work about. So welcome, Jamie.
Thank you very much.
In this paper, you describe how China is now increasingly turning wealth into power. But it's not a straightforward story, is it? And I think the best way would be if I let you explain a little bit about the general gist of the paper.
Absolutely. Well, I was really fascinated to look a little bit at the ways in which China's leaders and different parts of the Chinese government try to use China's burgeoning wealth to advance foreign policy goals, what we call economic statecraft. And so when I started to look at this, I found that there's really a wide range of tools that they can rely upon to try to push forward foreign policy objectives using these different economic resources. So it ranges from strategic distribution of foreign aid to selective investment in certain countries or regions of importance to China, selective what they call purchasing diplomacy in Chinese, which is the idea that when Chinese leaders go abroad, they might buy Boeing aircrafts or Airbuses based upon their political objectives, as much as the sort of economic rationale. And these go right through to sort of more coercive ends. So even sanctions, for example, China's increasingly using a unilateral sanction. So not necessarily a multilateral UN-organized sanctions, but short-term efforts to use economic pressure or coercion upon certain countries to advance what they would like to get. And we've seen this, for example, with regards to consumer boycotts even over Japan, some sanctions on Philippine bananas. So a wide range of sort of techniques that the Chinese government and different state-led actors are beginning to use more and more in China's foreign policy.
But reading your paper, it's very evident that China's leaders can't possibly just decide we are going to use money to meet objective A. It's a much more complicated story. For example, so many actors are involved. Can you describe these actors?
I'll talk a little bit about it, and then I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on this. Because there are actually a lot of constraints, and in some ways China trying to use economic statecraft finds itself acting in a way, the Chinese say, dropping a stone on your own foot in some counterproductive fashion. So sometimes trying to use economic leverage increases anxiety in other countries. It sends them running in the other direction. So Japan is a good example where China's been using more sort of economic pressure on Japan in their recent maritime dispute. And in fact, I think this has sort of strengthened conservative forces in Japan and brought Japan closer back to its alliance with the United States. So there's sort of a wide variety of problems that China has in trying to get everybody on the same page and trying to put forward foreign policy objectives in this sort of strategic fashion. And so I wanted to ask you, Linda, to talk a little bit about what you think in terms of what are the challenges that Beijing faces in trying to get all these different foreign policy actors to coordinate in implementing such a very complex and nuanced approach to foreign policy?
You know, I think it's nearly an impossible task. On the one hand, they really need to keep all of these actors somewhat satisfied. I don't think they can ever keep them happy, but they do have to take into account the wishes, the aspirations, the interests of a huge amount of groups, interest groups, I call them foreign policy actors. At the same time, they, of course, rely on these actors to keep political stability, to make sure that economic growth continues. So they can't just disregard the wishes and aspirations of the actors. But at the same time, all of these actors are out on the global stage acting in the name of China's benefit, in the name of China's national interest, so to speak. And they're often quite contradictory, these motives, the interests of the actors. So I would say that the Chinese top leadership really cannot expect to coordinate between all the actors, but they always have to choose which actors in which situation is more important.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
I really can't let you go before I ask you what your thoughts are regarding China's economic statecraft and Australia. Should Australia be worried that China will at some point want to coerce in some way using economic power Australia on an issue which the two sides don't see eye to eye on?
Well, I think it's a really important question. It's something I try to engage a little bit in the paper because, of course, the current new government in Australia, the Abbott government, is looking very hard at trying to conclude a free trade agreement with China, supposedly within the next 12 months. That's a tall order. But there's been a lot of concerns among different folks in Australia about whether or not it's even a good idea. And there's a lot of anxiety about the extent, as you mentioned, that China might use this sort of economic leverage, either in investment or trade, to sort of limit Australia's options or autonomy in its own policy choices, either at home or abroad. I think there's, while it's certainly a reasonable question, I don't think there's a need to be too overly concerned about that possibility for at least two reasons. First, as we talked about a moment ago, the sort of difficulty for Chinese leaders even coordinating among these different actors makes it really difficult to imagine a case where China would be willing to sort of and able to sort of coerce the Australian government in significant fashion. For the most part, those who are trading or purchasing from Australia or investing in Australia are state-owned enterprises controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, but they're primarily aimed at commercial objectives. They want to make money. These people get advanced in their jobs and succeed to the extent that they're profitable. So for the most part, they have a strong commercial objective, which really drives the choices in Australia. Secondly, the Australian government actually has far more leverage and power in this relationship than I think is often given credit to. Australia is primarily a major source of China's imports. China's iron ore imports, for example, are something that are extremely important to the government of Beijing, and they're not easily replaced from Australia. So Australia has a lot of leverage in the trade and investment relationship that I think will continue to be important going forward. And then, of course, part of this is the fact that domestic regulation in Australia remains extremely strong. The Australian government has shown its willingness on a number of occasions to limit the opportunities for Chinese companies to invest in mining operations, say, near sensitive military sites. There's been restrictions upon the Chinese private firm, Huawei, as effort to invest in Australia's national broadband network. So I don't think there's a concern that Australia's governmental capacity is somehow eroded in significant fashion, even if we go forward with continued deepening trade and investment ties with China. I think it's good for business in Australia, and if the politics are managed in a reasonable fashion, I think it can be beneficial for both sides.
Thank you, Jamie. And I can advise everyone to take a look and read the new paper by Jamie Riley, China's Economic Statecraft, Turning Wealth into Power. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Linda.